I never knew anyone so keenly alive to a joke as the king was. He seemed to live only for joking. To tell a good story of the joke kind, and to tell it well, was the surest road to his favor. Thus it happened that his seven ministers were all noted for their accomplishments as jokers. They all took after the king, too, in being large, corpulent, oily men, as well as inimitable jokers. Whether people grow fat by joking, or whether there is something in fat itself which predisposes to a joke, I have never been quite able to determine, but certain it is that lean joker is a vicentaries, about the refinements, or, as he called them, the ghost of wit. The king troubled himself very little. He had an especial admiration for breadth in a jest, and would often put up with length, for the sake of it. Over niceties wearied him. He would have preferred Rabelais, Gargantua, to the Zadig of Voltaire, and, upon the whole, practical jokes suited his taste far better than verbal ones. At the date of my narrative, professing jesters had not altogether gone out of fashion at court. Several of the great continental powers still retain their fools, who wore motley, with caps and bells, and who were expected to be always ready with sharp witticisms, at a moment's notice, in consideration of the crumbs that fell from the royal table. Our king, as a matter of course, retained his fool. The fact is, he required something in the way of folly, if only to counterbalance the heavy wisdom of the seven wise men, who were his ministers, not to mention himself. His fool, or professional jester, was not only a fool, however. His value was trebled in the eyes of the king by the fact of his being also a dwarf and a cripple. Dwarfs were as common at court, in those days, as fools, and many monarchs would have found it difficult to get through their days. Days are rather longer at court than elsewhere, without both a jester to laugh with and a dwarf to laugh at. But, as I have already observed, your jesters, in 99 cases, out of 100, are fat, round, and unwieldy, so that it was no small source of self-gratulation with our king, that, in Hop Frog, this was the fool's name, he possessed a triplicate treasure in one person. I believe the name, Hop Frog, was not that given to the dwarf by his sponsors at baptism, but it was conferred upon him, by general consent of the several ministers, on account of his inability to walk as other men do. In fact, Hop Frog could only get along by a sort of interjectional gait, something between a leap and a wriggle, a movement that afforded limitable amusement, and of course consolation, to the king. For, notwithstanding the protuberance of his stomach and a constitutional swelling of the head, the king, by his whole court, was accounted a capital figure. But although Hop Frog, through the distortion of his legs, could move only with great pain and difficulty along a road or floor, the prodigious muscular power which nature seemed to have bestowed upon his arms, by way of compensation for deficiency in the lower limbs, enabled him to perform many feats of wonderful dexterity, where trees or ropes were in question, or anything else to climb. At such exercises he certainly much more resembled a squirrel, or a small monkey, than a frog. I am not able to say, with precision, from what country Hop Frog originally came. It was from some barbarous region, however, that no person ever heard of a vast distance from the court of our king. Hop Frog, and a young girl very little less dwarfish than himself, although of exquisite proportions and a marvelous dancer, had been forcibly carried off from their respective homes in adjoining provinces, and sent as presents to the king by one of his ever-victorious generals. Under these circumstances, it is not to be wondered at that a close intimacy arose between the two little captives. Indeed, they soon became sworn friends. Hop Frog, who, although he made a great deal of sport, was by no means popular, had it not in his power to render Trippetta many services, but she, on account of her grace and exquisite beauty, although a dwarf, was universally admired and petted, so she possessed much influence, and never failed to use it, whenever she could, for the benefit of Hop Frog. On some grand state occasion, I forgot what the king determined to have a masquerade, and whenever a masquerade, or anything of that kind, occurred at our court, then the talents, both of Hop Frog and Trippetta, were sure to be called into play. Hop Frog, in especial, was so inventive in the way of getting up pageants, suggesting novel characters, and arranging costumes for masked balls, that nothing could be done, it seems, without his assistance. The night appointed for the fete had arrived. A gorgeous hall had been fitted up, under Trippetta's eye, with every kind of device which could possibly give eclat to a masquerade. The whole court was in a fever of expectation, As for costumes and characters, it might well be supposed that everybody had come to a decision on such points. Many had made up their minds as to what roles they should assume a week, or even a month, in advance, and, in fact, there was not a particle of indecision anywhere except in the case of the king and his seven ministers. Why they hesitated I never could tell, unless they did it by way of a joke. More probably, they found it difficult, on account of being so fat, to make up their minds. At all events, time flew, and, as a last resort, they sent for Trippetta and Hop Frog. When the two little friends obeyed the summons of the king, they found him sitting at his wine with the seven members of his cabinet council, but the monarch appeared to be in a very ill humor. He knew that Hop Frog was not fond of wine, for it excited the poor cripple almost to madness, and madness is no comfortable feeling. But the king loved his practical jokes, and took pleasure in forcing Hop Frog to drink and, as the king called it, to be merry. "Come here, Hop Frog," said he, as the jester and his friend entered the room. "Swallow this bumper to the health of your absent friends." Here Hop Frog sighed, "and then let us have the benefit of your invention. We want characters, characters, man, something novel out of the way. We are wearied with this everlasting sameness. Come, drink. The wine will brighten your wits." Hop Frog endeavored, as usual, to get up a jest in reply to these advances from the king, but the effort was too much. It happened to be the poor dwarf's birthday, and the command to drink to his absent friends forced the tears to his eyes. Many large, bitter drops fell into the goblet, as he took it, humbly, from the hand of the tyrant. "Ah! Ha! Ha!" roared the latter, as the dwarf reluctantly drained the beaker. "See what a glass of good wine can do. Why, your eyes are shining already, poor fellow." His large eyes gleamed rather than shone, for the effect of wine on his excitable brain was not more powerful than instantaneous. He placed the goblet nervously on the table, and looked round upon the company with a half-insane stare. They all seemed highly amused at the success of the king's joke. "And now to business," said the prime minister, a very fat man. "Yes," said the king, "come lend us your assistance. Characters, my fine fellow, we stand in need of characters, all of us, ha, ha, ha." And as this was seriously meant for a joke, his laugh was chorused by the seven. Hop Frog also laughed, although feebly and somewhat vacantly. "Come, come," said the king, impatiently, "have you nothing to suggest?" "I am endeavoring to think of something novel," replied the dwarf, abstractedly, for he was quite bewildered by the wine. "Endeavoring," cried the tyrant, fiercely, "what do you mean by that? Ah, I perceive, you are sulky, and want more wine. Here, drink this," and he poured out another gobletful, and offered it to the cripple, who merely gazed at it, gasping for breath. "Drink, I say," shouted the monster, "or by the fiends." The dwarf hesitated. The king grew purple with rage. The courtiers smirked. Trippetta, pale as a corpse, advanced to the monarch's seat, and, falling on her knees before him, implored him to spare her friend. The tyrant regarded her, for some moments, in evident wonder at her audacity. He seemed quite at a loss what to do or say how most becomingly to express his indignation. At last, without uttering a syllable, he pushed her violently from him, and threw the contents of the brimming goblet in her face. The poor girl got up the best she could, and, not daring even to sigh, resumed her position at the foot of the table. There was a dead silence for about half a minute, during which the falling of a leaf, or of a feather, might have been heard. It was interrupted by a low, but harsh and protracted grating sound which seemed to come at once from